Okay, our next case is number 19-13181, Ross Jackson versus Glenn Cowan et al. And Mr. Claybrook, you're up first.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. The police officers violated Mr. Jackson's rights in three principal ways. They refused to protect him from his hecklers. Instead, encouraging the hecklers to disrupt and cover up his speech, they wrongfully arrested him, and they treated him differently because of his race. In a series of cases that began in the 1930s with Hague, which involved communist sympathizers, the Supreme Court protected unpopular speakers in open public forums by ruling that the police could not take the side of those who were hostile to the speech, but had to protect the speakers and let them talk. These cases reached their climax in the civil rights era when the Supreme Court decided Cox, Edwards, Gregory, and other cases, making clear that police could not allow a heckler's veto of unpopular speech.
But can I ask a question about that? Because
yes, Your Honor.
I don't see this as a heckler's veto case, because in a heckler's veto case, the police arrest the speaker because of the reaction of the crowd. But in this case, the police gave the speaker's own conduct as the reason to arrest the speaker. So what lines this case up with a heckler's veto case?
Well, there are two violations here. One is that they did not protect him from those who were trying to obstruct and disrupt the speech in an open public forum. That's the heckler's veto part, that they were heckling him and stopping him and talking to others and having his speech.
But the university responds that this is an open public forum for other people to speak as well. And so to somehow protect Mr. Jackson from the other speakers, they would have to shut down the other speakers' speech.
Well,
right?
No, I want to make clear that that is not our position. We're not saying the police had to shut down the other speakers. We had to say they had to stop disrupting the speech that was taking place, and which was the first speech in the open public forum.
Essentially,
the Supreme Court said, yes, Your Honor.
I think your argument on the facts essentially is that the police could have let the students use their counter speech against Mr. Jackson, but they let the students get so close to him that they obstructed Mr. Jackson from his own speech. Isn't
exactly
that your argument on that issue?
Exactly, Your Honor. And as the Supreme Court said in Red Lion, the right of free speech does not include the right to snuff out the free speech of others, which is exactly what the hecklers were doing here. And the police officers were on full and fair notice that this was what the law required. Their conduct showed it. On day one, the officers repeatedly moved hostile listeners away from the white preachers, allowing them to talk.
I'm gonna ask this of opposing counsel later as well, but when you watch the video clips, which I did, on the clip in question, which is when the two students were in Mr. Jackson's face, and Mr. Jackson came to one of the officers, and I believe it was Officer Cowan, and asked if it was okay for the student to yell in his ear. And I think he had also indicated that he had tried to touch him, I guess, in the chest. But the officer did not address him and kept speaking to another student and was just sort of dismissive of Mr. Jackson. Is that part of your claim that shows that the officer was not at all interested in protecting Mr. Jackson's speech rights?
Well, that's part of it, Your Honor. And the facts are worse than that, because Mr. Jackson went over to ask for help from the officers and asked, is he allowed to yell in my ear like that? Can't you help me here? The students came as well. The hecklers came as well and said, can we keep on doing this? Can we, as long as we don't touch him, is it okay? Officer Cowan turns to Mr. Law, one of the hecklers, and says, yeah. And then, as you pointed out, he then turns to Mr. Jackson and goes like that, gives him the back of his hand. So at that point, what happens is that with that green light, the hecklers get right in Mr. Jackson's face, as Judge Jordan was saying. The district court doesn't mention that Mr. Jackson repeatedly asked the students to back off and to get out of his space, that law told Mr. Jackson that he wouldn't, or the law said he was getting hard looking at Mr. Jackson's fine ass, or that the police defendants just watched and listened to all this from close range with their arms crossed, saying and doing nothing. And there's also more that happened right after that. Mr. Jackson would preach with his arms extended, and the students repeatedly ducked under his arm in order to get right in his face and to obstruct him from talking to other students. Right before the arrest, they did that again, and Mr. Jackson loudly and repeatedly asked Law to back off. Law said he wouldn't, and when Mr. Jackson backpedaled away from him several steps, Law followed him step for step, saying right in his face and not allowing him to talk to others. The government defends on this was just a point counterpoint debate going on that they were watching. It wasn't that at all. It was
a brief of the piece. Can you address the probable cause to arrest him under simple battery under Georgia law?
No, they did not have that probable cause. And so let me go to that. After they molested Mr. Jackson, he was arrested. And the district court makes three major errors with respect to the arrest. First, it slants the facts against Mr. Jackson instead of taking them in his favor. District court doesn't mention that when Mr. Jackson had turned to the side and then raised his arm to try to continue preaching, this time instead of Law avoiding the arm, he leans in and lets it brush him ever so slightly. For a touching to be a battery under Georgia law, Your Honor, it must be done intentionally, and it must be of an insulting or provoking nature. Just brushing against someone when you're looking the other way isn't enough. Now, to make it sound intentional, Officer Cowan called this touching a strike in his written arrest report, and the district court picked up that language, as well, of course, as the officers in their brief. But Cowan, right after the arrest, tells a fellow officer that Jackson had only brushed against Law. And Dorsey, right after the arrest, goes over to Law and says, did he really touch you? Did he actually touch? And the prosecutor, after viewing the video, said it wasn't a strike. The video evidence shows that the only thing intentional was Law being the initiator and leaning in to get some superficial contact. There's also no evidence to support that Jackson.
Is there a case that's on point in under Georgia law that talks about that it has to be, the contact has to be of an insulting or provoking nature?
Yes, there are, and it's in the context of the affirmative defenses, which was the second error of the district court, not looking at the affirmative defenses of self-defense and stand your ground, that those statutory defenses that he had available to him. And the judge.
I don't understand your argument on the insulting and provoking nature. I've seen the video, so I understand your argument about the contact, but these are two people yelling at each other. Mr. Jackson just called the other, Mr. Law, a pervert, screaming in his face. The cops have just told them, don't touch each other because we'll arrest you if you touch somebody. You can't speak anymore. So if there were contact, I mean, it seems it's inherently insulting and provoking if there were contact between these two people as they're yelling at each other in the free speech zone. I don't understand your argument that it might not be insulting and provoking.
It's not inherent at all, Your Honor. Otherwise, the requirement for it to be insulting and provoking wouldn't have to be in the statute, but it is.
Well, no, but I mean, my point is, I understand if it was, you know, if it were people in the crowd who were just jostling one another, trying to get a better view, that might not be insulting or provoking contact. But we're talking about two people who have been yelling at each other in the free speech zone. One has just called the other a pervert really loudly in his face. It seems, and like I said, the police officers have just told them, don't touch each other. The rule for the free speech zone is don't touch each other. And then there was this contact. Now, I've seen the video. I think I understand your argument about whether the contact itself was sufficient. I understand that argument, but I really don't understand the argument that it wasn't.
Well, there are two responses as a matter of law, Your Honor. One of them is that under Georgia law, it can't be of an insulting and provoking nature if it's defensive. if he was acting in self-defense and standing his ground. So as a matter of law, the Georgia Supreme Court said, if that's what's happening, there's no crime at all. It can't be insulting and provoking. The other point I want to make quickly is that under Adekes, the Supreme Court said that when declarations of officers in support of summary judgment motions have evidentiary gaps, that itself requires summary judgment to be denied. And here, both Cowan and Dorsey submitted declarations in support of their summary judgment motion. They did not say that they considered what Mr. Jackson had done to have been in an insulting or provoking manner. The third error that, yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question, please? One of the arguments you make in the brief, it's not the only one, of course, but one of the factual premises for your constitutional argument is that Mr. Law and maybe one of the other students had already chest bumped Mr. Jackson, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The video is not all that clear about that. What do you rely on, the video, or do you rely on Mr. Jackson's testimony to that effect, or what?
I rely on both, Your Honor. And it brings up a point, again, of the facts have to be taken at this stage in Mr. Jackson's favor. It wasn't Mr. Jackson who was running around trying to get in the student's face. It was Mr. Law and Mr. Opperman who were running around, going under his arms and getting right in his face so he couldn't talk with others. They got right up to his nose. They're the ones who got there. They're the initiators. Now, from the angles of the camera, it's very difficult to see, okay, exactly what happened. It's clear from the camera that they hit three times, but it was Mr. Law who was the aggressor. It was Mr. Jackson who said that Law was the aggressor and who chest bumped him three times. So yes, that has to be taken in the light most favorable to Mr. Jackson. The Supreme Court said in Scott versus Harris, you don't have to accept our version of the events if the video says no, but it has to be blatantly contradictory. And it certainly is not that here.
Mr. Claybrook, in the other videos or the other clips, I know that some of the students or the spectators also were aggressive towards the speakers, but I didn't see any indication in any of the other videos where anyone touched, whether it was a speaker or the speaker touched a student. Is there any evidence of that in any of the other clips that maybe I didn't see?
Are you asking if any other student touched Mr. Jackson or Mr.?
No, in any of the other clips with the other, I think there were two or three speakers.
Oh, in the first day?
Yes.
There is no evidence that the speakers were touched on that day.
Okay, thank you. I didn't see any, but I wanted to confirm. Thank you.
Sure. Your Honor, I'm over my time, so.
Yes, you've saved all of your time for rebuttal, Mr. Claybrook. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Cusimano.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I'm Ellen Cusimano on behalf of the UGA officers. I'm going to just jump right into the discussion about the Fourth Amendment false arrest claim. I think the key to affirmance of that claim is the standard that applies, which is, of course, arguable probable cause.
Well, let me ask you a question before you dive into that part of the argument. Mr. Claybrook argues in his brief, and he's repeated here at oral argument, that Mr. Jackson contends that he was physically touched. He was contacted by Mr. Law and maybe Mr. Opperman because they chest bumped him. If that is the case, because we take the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and by the way, I'm not sure the video is clear on that, but it certainly doesn't negate Mr. Jackson's version of events, at least in my view. How are the officers justified in arresting Mr. Jackson for a touch and yet not interfering or doing anything when Law touches Jackson before that?
Well, I think Mr. Jackson has to come forth with some sort of case law saying that in that situation, officers are required to affirmatively intervene.
But why wouldn't they be affirmatively required to intervene if it's a simple battery? If they chest bumped him, then they would be arrested for simple battery, just like Mr. Jackson was. Wouldn't that be correct? Wouldn't that be under the statute? Wouldn't that be an intentional contact of an insulting or provoking nature? How could it not be insulting or provoking when you're chest bumping someone?
Well, that would be correct. But when you look at the video recordings, contact is not shown between the two gentlemen. I understand the video recordings that are at an awkward angle, but when you look at them, you see Mr. Law stand still and you see Mr. Jackson rising to the tips of his toes and thrusting his chest out at Mr. Law without making any contact. And so in that situation, I don't think an assault occurred or a battery occurred. If it did, then it occurred by Mr. Jackson.
Ms. Cusimano, why would it matter if the police could have had probable cause to arrest Mr. Law? Because the way I read the law at the time, the law, not the person, but the law, at the time was that the clearly established law in the 11th Circuit was that there was no First Amendment violation due to an arrest if the police had probable cause to arrest the person that they arrested. So isn't that really the only probable cause question in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. There is no law stating that a failure to intervene violates the First Amendment. So again, I do want to turn to the concept of arguable probable cause. You know, this court most recently stated in Paez that actual probable cause is not a high bar. So arguable probable cause is an even lower bar. It requires only that a reasonable officer could, but not necessarily would, have believed probable cause existed. So stating that somewhat differently, Mr. Jackson has to show that no reasonable officer would have believed a battery occurred. And he cannot meet that high burden here based on the video evidence. When you look at the recordings, it shows that Mr. Jackson raised his hand and his arm away, up and away from his body toward Mr. Law, made physical contact with the side of Mr. Law's head.
The video repeatedly shows Mr. Law would raise his hand because he had his hand raised with a Bible. Correct? Is that not what the video shows?
That is correct.
And he's holding the Bible. And that's what he's doing while Mr. Law is yelling in his face and repeatedly walking forward towards Mr. Jackson. And Mr. Jackson is having to walk backwards with his hands up. So the way I look at that video, he has his hands up as a way of saying, I'm not going to touch you, right? And when the video shows at that moment where he's going to raise his hands as he's been doing before, which he's going to hold the Bible, Mr. Law goes under it. And when he puts his hands down, he touches Mr. Law.
Well, Mr. Law has a right to stand his own ground. He is not required to duck when that happens.
Now you're saying there's a right to stand your ground. So why doesn't Mr. Jackson have a right to stand his ground?
He certainly does, but again, I think the court's precedent is clear that affirmative defenses don't defeat qualified immunity in this case.
What do you do about, and you may ultimately prevail in this case given the state of the law, but let me tell you from my perspective, the police officers did not cover themselves in glory that day. Officer Cowan writes in his report that there was a strike, and then it turns out that there was a touch or a brush. And then Officer Cowan is heard on the video saying, quote unquote, we hit a home run and we took him down. That does not speak very well of law enforcement at the University of Georgia. And it goes to show, it may not be enough for Mr. Jackson to prevail, but it goes to show that the police weren't really doing an objective job out there. by letting the two students harass him as much as possible, incite him, and then the minute that something went a little bit awry, arresting the person whose speech they didn't agree with.
I have 2 points to address, Your Honor. With respect to the comment about hitting a home run, that has been taken out of context. Sergeant Cowan deposed that what he actually said was he was describing the reaction of the crowd, and that the crowd reacted as if he had hit a home run.
The evidence has to be viewed in the light most favorable to Mr. Jackson, Ms. Cusimano. And so his explanation for that comment doesn't get accepted at summary judgment. It just doesn't.
And I understand that, except if there's a video recording that refutes that version, then
it doesn't. It doesn't, because it's his explanation for making the statement. It's his statement.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at that video recording in that particular part of the statement, he is clearly saying that it was like he hit a home run and he was merely describing the situation. I will admit that certainly the officers, it may have been prudent for them to have intervened here. The problem though is that
the issue also is that when you watch day one of the videos, when you have the students who are clearly in the face of the speakers on day one, and they're clearly going to try to touch the speakers, the officers very, very quickly tell the students, don't touch him. So, but they never do anything to protect the speakers.
On the second day. And there's a reason for that. On the first day, the students had been in this situation for the first time. They did not know the ground rules. And so the officers were educating them on what they could and could not do.
I don't understand why there even have to be ground rules. We have a First Amendment. So anyone can say anything, even if it's offensive. And absolutely, that doesn't mean that I have to get in their face or anyone has to get in their face. You can just listen to someone.
Absolutely. But
I don't even understand why there has to be an explanation to supposed college students who supposedly are there for higher education and have to be explained what a First Amendment right is.
Well, that's because when the officers entered the circle, they saw students being restrained by other students. They felt that violence had either already occurred or was about to occur. And so they had to explain to the students that, look, you may find this offensive, but you cannot touch these preachers. The second day is different though, because on the second day we're dealing with Mr. Law, and Mr. Law had already had a conversation with the officers where the officers told him, you have every right to engage in free speech, but you can't touch him. And Mr. Law assures the officers on that second day that he understands that he's not going to touch Mr. Jackson, and that he merely wants to counter debate with Mr. Jackson. And I also want to address another point about...
You think as an abstract matter, Ms. Cusimano, and I know this doesn't necessarily reflect on the outcome here, but you think as an abstract matter that any person in society has a First Amendment right to scream in the ear of someone else?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
You do? Really? What principle of law lets someone do that?
Well, I would point to various First Amendment statements from the Supreme Court. For example, in Snyder versus Phelps, the court says debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open.
But in Snyder v. Phelps, they are on the opposite sides. You have a right to protest even at a funeral, but you don't have a right to protest inside. You don't have a right to go up to one of the mourners and start yelling in their ear. That's not what that case stands for at all.
Yeah, I'm not, I think Judge Legault was right. I'm not asking about the substance of the communication. I don't I don't dispute the right of the students to say what they wanted to say to Mr. Jackson. My point is, what, as an abstract First Amendment matter, what gave them the right to scream in Mr. Jackson's ear?
Well, first of all, I don't believe video recordings show any evidence of screaming in Mr. Jackson's ear. They're certainly yelling and elevating their voices, but at no point do they get up right to Mr. Jackson's ear and scream in his ear from the perspective of the officer's video recordings, which is the only perspective that matters in this case.
But that's in fact not accurate, because you have in the video Mr. Jackson go up to the officers and say, do they have the right to scream in my ear? And the officers do not even respond to him. So he made it clear to them that they had just yelled in his ear. Whether or not the video shows it, but we have to take the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Jackson. And the officers were advised of that, and they didn't do anything. They didn't tell the students, hey, stop yelling in his ear.
Certainly, but for the purposes of qualified immunity, Mr. Jackson has to point to a case saying that screaming in somebody's ear is not allowed. And I cannot find any cases from Georgia courts or this court saying that that is not allowed. And I think with regards to that incident, Chief Williamson made an interesting point, which is that at that time, Sergeant Cowan was having a conversation with other students. And if Mr. Jackson believed that that point was a strong point that he wanted addressed, he could have waited for the end of that conversation to ask his question. Instead, he turned around and he left. I do want to quickly turn to the First Amendment issue in this case. The reality is that Mr. Jackson, Mr. Law, Mr. Opperman, and all of the other students had an equal right to engage in free speech. And there is no existing binding precedent saying that officers have to intervene and protect one speaker at the potential detriment of another speaker. Instead, I think the law requires everyone to be engage in an equal speech.
Put qualified immunity, we have the option in this case when addressing qualified immunity of also addressing whether or not there was a constitutional violation before getting to the qualified immunity issue. So do you think that there was any violation of Mr. Jackson's rights here, viewing the facts in the light most favorable to him?
No, Your Honor, I do not. I totaled the amount of times that Mr. Jackson could be seen speaking over, or Mr. Law could be seen speaking over Mr. Jackson, and that totaled to only 2 minutes and 40 seconds. Mr. Jackson was speaking.
And that's too little a time for you?
Yes, Your Honor, given the fact that Mr. Jackson was speaking for 40 minutes, that means he had 37 minutes of clearly expressing his ideas. And I see my time.
If he had been bothered or accosted by Mr. Law for 10 minutes, would that be enough?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. There are no guidelines to show what would be enough. And that's the problem here. And if I may continue for just a little bit longer, I think a First Amendment violation here would be problematic. Because when is the line crossed? Is it when a speaker gets 10 inches in front of somebody's face? What about 1 foot, 2 feet, 3 feet? Does it matter the decibel level that is being spoken at? Does it matter the number of times that the speakers follow the other speaker? That's going to be very hard to implement. And so with that, I will, unless the court has any other questions, I will turn it back to Mr. Claybrook.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Cusimano. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Claybrook, you've got your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think I can address many of the issues that have been raised by talking about the fact that the Supreme Court recently decided Lozman and Nieves, but the district court erred in failing to apply them.
No, that is not right, because the question here is qualified immunity. So we have to look at what the clearly established law was at the time of these events. And although if in Lozman it was municipal liability, qualified immunity wasn't at issue there. In Neves or Nieves, qualified immunity wasn't an issue there because the Ninth Circuit had denied qualified immunity on the basis of clearly established Ninth Circuit law. So if we're looking at clearly established law at the time, we'd have to look at the 11th Circuit's law, right? And the 11th Circuit had already said, you can't bring a First Amendment retaliation claim when there's probable cause for the arrest, right? So it just doesn't matter what the Supreme Court said later on.
That's not a correct view of the law in this respect.
Right. Why am I wrong about that?
You're wrong because, first of all, the Supreme Court applied both its decisions in Lozman and Nieves to the conduct at issue, which predated its the decisions, obviously.
But isn't Judge Brasher, at least with regards to Lozman, isn't Judge Brasher right that in a municipal liability case, you don't have the issue of qualified immunity, and you also don't have the issue of clearly established law? If a municipality has a custom, policy, or practice that violates a constitutional right and meet all the standards of Monell liability, then you're on the hook. It doesn't matter what the clearly established law was. That's sort of the trade-off the Supreme Court has created with municipal liability. Qualified immunity, right?
It has, Your Honor, but it's not the way it decided Lozman. It decided on Lozman, and let me first predicate this by saying that in both Lozman and in Nieves, the Supreme Court iterated that for decades, the law has been clearly established that a police officer cannot arrest someone because of the content of his speech. That's called a retaliatory arrest. Now, what they're talking about in Lozman and Nieves is there a bar to such a suit because the police had probable cause independent of the retaliation for an independent non-speech reason. And if so, you can't make your causation proof. And so you have to dismiss the suit. That's not going to the subject matter of the retaliation. That's what has to be clearly established. And the Supreme Court said it has been clearly established. And so here you must apply the exceptions that both Lozman and Nieves point out, one for premeditated decision to snuff out the speech, another for showing that, hey, they don't arrest typically in this circumstance. And so it shows that the reason they really did arrest her was because of the content of the speech. Those police defendants do not contest in their briefs that if those exceptions apply, that they apply here to these facts. And both this circuit and DeMartini and the 5th, 7th, 9th, and 10th circuits, all precedential opinions have applied.
In the 7th circuit case that you filed as a supplemental authority, the 7th circuit held that the police officers got qualified immunity because the law was not clearly established at the time. That was the holding of the 7th circuit in the case that you filed.
The plaintiffs did not always win. They sometimes did in those cases. They didn't always win. The point that I'm making, Your Honor, is that in each case, they rebutted what the district court did here, which is I don't have to consider it because it hadn't been decided when the events took place, and they applied it to pre-decisional facts. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Claybrook. Thank you, Ms. Cusimano. We appreciate the help.
Thank you. Thank you both.